Vedanta teacher James Swartz on Bhagavad Gita. An audio workshop brought to you by meinyogalehrer.de, recorded in Yoga Vidya Westerwald Ashram in Germany on March 2013. Part 4 of 13.
Om Brahmanandam Paramasukhidam Kevalam Yanamurtim Dvandvatitam Gandhamisadrisham Tattvamasya Adilaksham Ekam Nityam Vimalamachalam Sarvadi Sakshibhutam Bhavatitam Triguna Rahitam Sadgurum Tam Namami Narayanam Padmavavam Vashishtam Shaktim Chatatputra Parasarancha Vyasam Sukham Gaudapadam Mahantam Govinda Yogim Ramatas Yashisham Shri Shankaracharya Matasya Padmaha Padam Chahastamalakam Shishisham Tam Totikam Vartika Karamanyan Asmad Gurum Shantatam Anatoshmihi Vishwam Darpana Drishyamanya Nagari Tulyam Nijantargatam Pashyanatmani Mayaya Bhayurivod Bhutam Yata Nidraya Yasakshat Kurute Prabodha Samaye Svatmanameva Dvayam Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namaidam Shri Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Om Govinda Krishna Paramatmana. Now this thing about Vedanta, it's a complete teaching. It's not just the experience of an individual. A person who's enlightened, there are many enlightened people, but there are only of a 100 enlightened people, only one or two are good teachers, and only one or two of those understand that teaching is not about your personal experience. If a teacher's enlightened, he or she can only teach you what his or her personal experience is, unless they have a valid means of proven impersonal means of knowledge, like Vedanta. So, over the centuries, this is thousands of years old, all the doubts that you can have been worked out and answered by the means of knowledge itself. Whereas any individual teacher can only answer a few doubts that he or she is capable of solving on their own. And you'll see as we proceed with these teachings, we're going to get some very sophisticated teachings. The three gunas, the three states, and so forth and so on. Ishwara, Jiva, but these teachings. No human being could actually develop those teachings. Maybe one or two of those teachings they may be able to intuitively grasp, but they won't be able to communicate it in a clear, scientific, impersonal language. And no person could come up with all the teachings that are necessary for a complete means of knowledge. That's why Vedanta is the king of the teachings. It's the very pinnacle, the very top teaching of all the teachings. There's no teaching like this anywhere. And all the other teachings have bits and pieces of the Vedanta, but they don't have the whole teaching. Even Buddhism, we say, is a chip off the tooth of the Veda. The Veda is a tooth, and Buddhism is one little chip came off. The Buddha was a Hindu. He picked up many things from this tradition. But you won't find the whole teaching in any of the Buddhist teachings. You'll find bits and pieces. You'll find some of it's quite good and some of it's very incorrect.
What about Dzogchen teachings?
Pardon?
What about Dzogchen teachings in Tibetan Buddhism?
The Dzogchen teachings of Tibetan Buddhism are very close. Okay. Are very similar.
We've got the same understanding. Okay. Huh? Thank you.
They are. That's the best that I've come across. I had a very nice discussion recently with a very advanced Dzogchen student who's studying with a master in Tibet. And because I'm very curious. Mm-hmm. And they were as close as you get to Vedanta.
Okay.
But the whole means of knowledge, I didn't understand. In a short discussion with him, I couldn't figure it all out. But in any case, so that's the difference between Vedanta and the experience of an enlightened person. We say there's two kinds of teachings. One is called Shruti, that's Vedanta, and the other is called Smriti, that's remembered or personal experience. Shruti is what is heard or seen. Now, if you hear something or see something, it doesn't come from you, does it? It comes from the outside. Knowledge is not subject-based. Knowledge is not based upon me. See? Knowledge is based upon the object. Like if you see a tree, there, and you understand it, the tree knowledge has nothing to do with me. It's not a subjective knowledge. It's an objective knowledge. It comes from the outside. Huh? Now, I can have all sorts of feelings and thoughts about a tree. Huh? That's called subjective knowledge. That's my experience of a tree. But my experience of the tree is the interpretation of my conditioning around that piece of knowledge, tree knowledge. And I need to separate my interpretation of the object, of the knowledge, from the knowledge itself. That's Shruti. Shruti is something that comes from the outside. And the self, awareness, is outside of the person. It's beyond or outside or transcendent of the person. It doesn't come from the person. The person comes from awareness. See? So, and Smriti is what? What I personally experience. Now, many people experience and know the self, and know they are the self. There's two kinds of knowledge, direct knowledge and indirect knowledge. Indirect knowledge, we're going to see, is I know the self. That means I'm me and I know the self as an object. And direct knowledge is I am the self. Understand? It's two kinds of knowledge. Now, if a person has direct or indirect knowledge of the self, he or she is a jivan mukta, that is, a free person, assuming that knowledge has what? Neutralized his or her conditioning, his or her binding vasanas. But that doesn't make that person a teacher. That doesn't qualify them to teach. That we call a brahmanishta. You'll see this terminology in Sanskrit, a brahmanishta. Nishta means a person who's established in awareness. Brahman means awareness. Who's established in awareness as awareness. That is, their identity is awareness. Their primary identity is awareness. They will have a secondary identity as what? As a person. But their first identity is, I'm awareness. And that knowledge is firm. It's hard and fast. No matter what comes up from within them, they don't forget that they're awareness. It's just solid knowledge. That's called a brahmanishta. That's a free being. Now, there's another idea, and that's another kind of person, and that's called a Shrotriya. A Shrotriya is a teacher. A Shrotriya is somebody who is established in Brahman, as Brahman, but has what? Has knowledge of a scripture. Can communicate this knowledge impersonally. So when you come to Vedanta, you don't surrender to the teacher. You surrender to the knowledge. And you want to surrender to something that's impersonal. You don't want to surrender to a person. If you surrender to a person, you'll find yourself in trouble. You will definitely have problems. Because that person will just be a person with a certain prejudice and idea. And their teachings, they will demand that you see the teaching as they see it personally. And if you don't see it like they see it personally, then you will have a conflict with that teacher. And so you cannot, see, Vedanta is impersonal. So it's not from human beings. So a human being can't interpret it. I am not interpreting this scripture. This has nothing to do with me. I'm just a professional teacher. I'm just teaching what the scripture says. And I'm making it in a language in a way that is understandable to you. But it has nothing to do with me. You don't know who I am. You don't know what I experience or what I know or what you have. Nobody knows. I just appear here one fine day. Huh, don't I? I may be an axe murderer. Or a child molester. Who knows? See? It has nothing to do with me. If I'm teaching this knowledge, the knowledge will work on you because it's impersonal. That's the point. Anyway, so these questions, So questions are always, this means of knowledge has got it all figured out. That's the beauty of it. And when you see that, you understand that every question has been answered. Then you really can relax. You just feel so confident. You know you're on the bus, on the Vedanta bus. You will get to the destination. This will take you there because it's taken people there forever. Maybe it will run out of gas. Somebody will come and fill it up. Maybe it will have a flat tire. Yes, but you just sit on the bus and enjoy yourself. You put your burden down and allow the teaching to what? Clear your doubts. Anyway, so do we have a small question?
In general, isn't every translation at the same time an interpretation? Because we saw different, for example, kinds of, if you look on different books on Bhagavad Gita, The same text is every teacher in a little different...
Well, that's right, but is that teacher teaching according to the tradition? Because that's the point. Anybody can write a commentary on a text. Anybody can say anything. But is that person's teaching in harmony with the teaching of Vedanta? See? Sometimes they are. If a person says something that's in harmony with the scripture, with Shruti, then we accept it. And if not, then you have to go back and see if what they're saying is actually true or not. You have to question what the teacher is saying if it doesn't fit in with here. Now, people do interpret this text. That's the problem. They say they're teachers, and they say they're, that how they see this verse is the way to see it. Now, in some of these verses, even Swami Dayananda, who's the head of our lineage now, the top person in our lineage, even he says, now you can take this verse to mean this, or you can take this verse to mean this. There are two or three possible ways to understand the meaning of a verse. That is possible. The reason being because Sanskrit, one word, can have 10 different meanings. The word dharma, I've given you small definitions of dharma. We have many other words that dharma refers to many other things. So in that case, where the meaning of the word is not clear, then we have to refer to the context in which the word is presented, for one. And then if that's not clear, then we have to refer to other texts and other commentaries to see if they jibe with the whole tradition. And even in the tradition itself, there are arguments about the importance of various teachings, but the basic fundamental teaching itself, there's no argument about. For example, that the problem is knowledge, not experience, that the method of that ignorance is the issue, that the way to remove ignorance is what? Through gaining knowledge, that you need a means of knowledge to gain knowledge, and so forth and so on. All the teachers agree on the basic structure of Vedanta. But within that, there's room for discussion. Anyway, let's get on with the Karma Yoga. I'm sorry I got off track. But it's not really off track. All of these are important issues. So Karma Yoga is an attitude that I take with respect to action and its results. That's not to say that I don't want things. We're not trying to stop you wanting things. See? If you're a sannyasi, if you're qualified for knowledge, you don't want things anyway. That's what a sannyasi is. A sannyasi is a person who doesn't want anything from the world. So he doesn't have any worldly wants. The sannyasi's only desire is moksha. He hasn't got this desire problem. He's got one desire, and it's for moksha. But worldly people have many desires, and one of their desires is for moksha. And if their desire is for moksha, then they're a mumukshu, or a seeker of what? Moksha. They're a seeker of knowledge. You understand? So you're going to have your desires. It's not about being desireless. And it's not about doing action. It's not about avoiding action or sitting in a cave and meditating all day, because sitting in a cave and meditating all day is also an action done by a doer. And it's going to have various results according to the nature of the mind. So it's not about getting rid of your desires at all. It's about acting out your desires every day as they come up, acting them out, with this spirit of renunciation. Renunciation of what? Not of stuff. It's not renouncing stuff, it's renouncing the result of the action. So when you're going for something, and you are going for something all the time, what you do in Karma Yoga is you consecrate the action to Bhagavan, to Ishvara. Consecrate means you turn over, you say, this is for you, Ishvara. I'm doing this for you. And you will teach me through the result of the action. Because you offer your action to Ishwara, Ishwara will give you a result that will teach you who you are and how to move and where to go. Yes?
And this is not only in terms of action, also in terms of feelings, and thoughts.
Absolutely. That's a very important point. What you think and feel, the feelings and thoughts that you have, should also be consecrated or offered to Ishwara. When you get stuck in a certain emotion, you should what? Offer that to Ishwara. That's called bhakti. My work, whatever I have, I consecrate or give or make as an offering, a worship to Ishwara, my own self. See, we're setting up, karma yoga sets up a communication between you and yourself. See, from Ishwara's point of view, you're already enlightened. You're already Ishwara. Understand? Why? Why is that? Because reality is non-dual. There's nothing that isn't Ishwara. There's nothing that isn't you, isn't consciousness, isn't Ishwara. There's nothing that isn't that. So from Ishwara's understanding, Ishwara's knowledge, you're already enlightened. So to get Ishwara's attention, but you're saying, but sir, but Ishwara, gee, however you want to see it, as however you want to conceive of Ishwara, say, but hey, I don't feel enlightened. I'm suffering. I need help. Every action should be an appeal, a prayer to Ishwara, please reveal yourself to me through the results of these actions. Well, how does Ishwara reveal itself to you through the result of an action? It purifies your mind, and then Ishwara's, when that action is consecrated, there's a burst of light or energy or feeling in your heart. There's a feeling of peace and satisfaction and love, and however, there's a subjective result that happens when you make this consecration, and that draws you closer to Ishwara. You feel, you understand at some deep level that you're doing yourself a big favor by what? Thinking and feeling and acting in this way. Yourself understands, and it comes closer to you. Every step you take, with every action you take, Ishwara seems to come closer to you. This is how you develop a communication or a relationship with Ishwara. And what happens is that the obstacles that you feel inside yourself, those are dissolved through this practice. What are those obstacles? What's that?
Vasanas.
Yeah. Your likes and your dislikes, your vasanas. That's correct. So every time that you give your actions to Ishwara, your actions, your thoughts, your feelings, when you offer everything to Ishwara, every time you do that, you burn up, you destroy the vasana in play at the moment. You know Patanjali? Chitta Vritti Nirodha? It's the same idea. Patanjali says, right? How many have read the Yoga Sutras? Well, see, a lot of people have read the Yoga Sutras. And the Yoga Sutras said, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. It's a nice verse, isn't it? Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. It's all right. Yoga is the removal of the vrittis in the citta, the vasanas. So what the vrittis are? The vrittis are the vasanas in the citta. The citta is the causal body. Those vrittis, those vasanas are there, and yoga is getting rid of those. And then he says the next verse, and then the seer shines in all its glory. Then the self is revealed. Why? What? When the vasana goes, the rajas and the tamas that's producing the vasana go, and awareness illumines the subtle body, and you experience awareness reflected in your heart. And a little bit of karma yoga, huh? A little bit of it, you start to feel really good. And your anxiety for the result of the action that you're doing, whatever they are, that just slowly disappears. Understand? And in this whole process, this whole spiritual practice, this whole process is brought about what is called karma yoga. So that most people, they think spirituality is one thing and their life is something else. They go to ashrams and go to these places. Why? Because they want to get away from that life and get into this life, into the ashram life or the spiritual life. They think it's different, but there's no difference. It's the same in the spiritual world as it is in the worldly world. You're doing actions for results. Same. The doer, the ego, that hasn't run away. It's the ego that's gone from a worldly person to a spiritual person. Now the ego's doing sattvic actions and spiritual actions, but the ego is doing it for results. So you can go to an ashram and not understand karma yoga, and not remove your ego at all. In fact, you can build up a big ego, thinking that you're what? Doing special kinds of actions that are going to produce a special kind of result that isn't available in the world. So all human beings, irrespective of their circumstances, who want moksha are going to have to do karma yoga, because that's the only way you're going to get rid of these obstructions, these things that are preventing you from appreciating your nature. See the logic. See the logic. You cannot argue with this logic.
But this doesn't mean that I don't have certain expectations if I'm happy. It means that I accept whatever comes.
That's right.
No? If I do an action, I can have some wanting.
Yeah, you will. You do have an expectation.
Because sometimes you hear you have to give up the wanting.
Yeah.
And that's not the way, no?
Huh? The wanting, you can leave the wanting there.
Yes.
You don't have control over the wanting anyway. The wanting is just there all the time. It's coming from the unmanifest. You see? Like, I have an expectation. When I come and teach, I expect you to listen. If you don't listen, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Am I going to get angry? Huh? Say I come in here and you don't want to hear. And you're all going, oh God, when is this over? Will that man shut up? Please. I've heard this before. Now, what should I do if you're like that? Should I get upset? No. Will it make you listen if I get upset? No. Will it make me happy if I get upset? No. What do I have to do? I have to say, oh, Bhagawan isn't listening today. I'll keep talking anyway because I like to talk. And I'll keep enjoying myself whether I get the result that I want or not. You know, I don't know if you ever, you're probably all too young, but there was this teacher called Jay Krishnamurti. Did you ever hear him?
Yeah.
Krishnamurti? He was an old guy. He's dead and gone now. And he had a big impact on spirituality, maybe 30, 40 years ago. Now almost nobody reads Krishnamurti. A few old people are still attached to Jay Krishnamurti and his teachings. And he was a very bad teacher. And he did, first of all, he didn't really have a teaching. And second, he was a bad teacher. And he wasn't meant to be a teacher, actually. But he was very famous. And he was a very cool guy. And he couldn't communicate very well. And so people just weren't getting it. It's as simple as that. And he used to get so angry. Oh, he would, I mean, he was an Indian, had dark skin, but you could just see that. It just turned red. I mean, he was and he would point at everybody, and he would shout at the audience, and what is wrong with you? You're so stupid. You don't get it. This is so simple. What's wrong with you? Huh? He knows no karma yoga. He wanted this result. He wanted them to understand. He wanted you to get enlightened. He thought he had the greatest teaching and so forth and so on. But that spirit of the karma yoga wasn't there. And he was a very frustrated person. So what we're saying here is, yeah, want what you want. Right? Give the result up to Bhagawan when you do the action. Don't think about it after that. That will keep your mind right here now. Huh? You know Eckhart's teaching, be in the now? How many have read Eckhart's book? Yeah. Okay, the power of now. The power of now is what? Having the mind present here. I don't know why Eckhart didn't teach karma yoga, because karma yoga is the way that you get to bring the mind to the present. By what? Offering the result to Bhagawan. Because Bhagawan's in charge anyway. You're not. That the interesting thing is, you're not doing anything unique or special because you're not in charge in the first place. But you know the ego, you know how it is. Huh? It wants what it wants. It wants it the way it wants it. And it wants it when it wants it. And it doesn't want to leave things up to anybody else. Isn't it? You know how your ego is? Everybody's got the same ego. Everybody, it's true for everybody. Huh? And what karma yoga says is just think about it. It's not up to you, so leave it to Bhagawan. The results are going to come. They're coming from somebody or somewhere. So let's just turn them over to Bhagawan as we do our action and free the mind of the anxiety for the result. And if you do that with every action, your mind will remain present. When your mind is present, here and now present, you can respond effectively to what reality is asking of you. How beautiful. What a beautiful practice. What an amazing practice. What a powerful practice. That means everything I'm doing, not just chanting or praying or meditating or working in the ashram or whatever, not just that, but everything I do becomes my sadhana, becomes a sadhana.
And how can I do this with emotions? With action, it's clear. But what means this karma yoga attitude in terms of feelings, bad feelings?
Okay, I have a bad feeling. Now, what should I do with that feeling? I should understand that what? That belongs to Ishwara. So I no longer identify with that feeling. I offer that back to Ishwara by what? Non-identification with the feeling.
It's just about knowing, not to do something, just that, to remember, this bad feeling.
That's right. And that's right. And then it goes back to Ishwara. Now, that doesn't mean what? That doesn't mean the feeling will instantly disappear. Now, sometimes it does. Sometimes as soon as you turn your attention to Ishwara, to awareness, you see, because Ishwara is present all the time with every feeling. Every time you have a feeling, awareness is there, isn't it? You can't have a feeling unless awareness is shining on the feeling, can you? The feeling comes up, okay, I'm depressed. Now the feeling is there, but the feeling isn't feeling anything. The feeling isn't feeling. Awareness is feeling it because it's identifying with the feeling. Why does it do that? Because it's ignorant of its nature. Awareness is what? Under the spell of Maya, it's ignorant. And so it's identified with the feeling, and then it feels the feeling. So when I have a feeling, what do? I look for the awareness, not at the feeling. I take my attention now is going what? On the feeling. And what I do now is I turn my attention back to me, to awareness. When I do that, the feeling shrinks. It can just it can go poof. If it's a certain kind of feeling, it can go, where did that go? So it was there and now it's gone. Why? Because the only thing that kept the feeling there was that I was paying attention to that feeling. I wasn't looking at myself. So when I, now maybe it's a deep vasana, it's a big, strong feeling, then what will happen? Well, it won't disappear instantly because it has a certain karma to play out, but it will shrink. You'll see it as an object. It won't any longer feel like I'm feeling. It will feel like, oh, there's a bad feeling there. There's a bad feeling appearing in me. And then you just stay with the awareness, with the eye, and the feeling eventually goes away. As the gunas change, the feelings change. Okay?
Okay.
That's the short answer. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sometimes not sure if I should give certain emotions or certain, like an illness, for example, or a feeling. Sometimes it's that you should give it love, you know? You should, like, when you see it or your ego, you should give it love. But isn't that giving attention as well?
Yes, it is.
So in that moment, do you recommend just not to try and, yeah?
Well, ask yourself, where is this love coming from that you're giving? Where is that love coming from?
From awareness.
From awareness, from me. Awareness is love. That's what awareness is. Awareness is love. So I look at the source, at the source of the love, and my attention goes back to the love, to me, and then what? The illness just becomes an object. Now, if you're sick, it's going to be there for a while. I don't know if you, most of you weren't here last year, but I had a nasty cold. But I think everybody enjoyed and had a good teaching. But I was feeling lousy. I was feeling rotten. But I just looked at everything from the point of view of awareness, and the cold was an object, and I talked through the cold and around the cold. And I knew that it would go away. It wasn't under my control. It was under Ishwara's control. Understand? This is why we need to understand Ishwara, because Ishwara is in control of our experience. Awareness isn't in control. Awareness, there's no experience for awareness, and it doesn't care. Whatever experience is appearing in awareness, it doesn't have any problem with it. Bad, the worst, ugliest, nastiest feelings are not a problem for awareness. And the very beautiful, best, most incredible, spiritual, wonderful, loving, compassionate feelings are not a problem for awareness. It doesn't care. They're all the same to awareness. That sounds funny, doesn't it? Oh, no, it's not. Awareness is completely indifferent to all experience. But knowledge says that what the experience is coming from Ishwara. And when I understand that, then what? I can remain as awareness and let Ishwara generate the experience that it generates according to my past actions, my karma. My karma is Ishwara. Ishwara is the one that delivers my karma to me. It creates my karma, it holds my karma in the causal body, and it delivers my karma back to me. Now, if I'm a jiva, I'm what? I'm receiving the karma. But if I'm awareness, the karma is not going to me, is it? Karma can't get across that Maya line. It can't go up and affect you. Karma always stays below the Maya line and only affects the jiva. Understand? So karma yoga is the key to spiritual life. That's the key. Then, once we got that clear, then we move right on to the other topics. Then knowledge, meditation, the gurus, all this stuff makes sense. But without karma yoga, what you're going to be doing is shooting yourself in the foot. Every step you make forward, you'll make a step backward. Why? Because you'll keep making the vasanas. You'll keep conditioning yourself. It's the problem. But with karma yoga, you're deconditioning, you're unlearning, you're deconstructing your karma with karma. You're using karma, it's like a thorn to take out a thorn. You're using karma to remove karma. See, it doesn't have anything to do with working in an ashram or helping poor people or anything. It has nothing to do with that. That can be karma yoga, or it can be what? Purely desire-oriented activity. It can just produce vasanas. There's a lot of people in the spiritual world who think they're so spiritual because they're giving their whole life to the guru or to an ashram or to whatever it is. And they have these huge spiritual egos that make them feel so special and so spiritual and so wonderful because they're doing this particular kind of action, which what makes them feel virtuous. But all they're getting is one great big spiritual vasana. And we don't want spiritual vasanas, and we don't want worldly vasanas. We don't want any vasanas. Well, we can't get rid of them all, but we've got to get rid of enough of our vasanas what so our mind becomes calm. Yes, sir.
I have a rather long question. Can I get some things straight?
Yeah.
Since Ishwara is in control of our gunas, mind, ego, intellect, body, etc., how can we not act according to Ishwara? If there is any choice for the ego, the person, or, as you would say, Arjuna, story, it only lies in choosing a sattvic thing to do in the situation, and therefore becoming aware of its true self, which is pure awareness.
Yes.
Meaning its ability, or the individual, the non-existent individual can choose domestic and rajasic actions, which will lead to it sinking into Maya.
Yes.
A life of the continuous suffering through the vasanas and the vidya.
Yes.
Even the choices we make in this tamasic and rajasic state of awareness seems to be because of Ishvara.
That's right.
So how can Arjuna be wrongdoing if he's only an entity completely maintained and led by Ishvara?
Oh, what a physical, clever fellow. Very good.
Have some more.
Can we do it in little bits? Because I already forgot that. Sorry that.
No, he's saying that Ishwar is controlling the good stuff and the bad stuff. That everything's Ishwar. Isn't that right?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, huh? That's basically what you're saying.
The difference only lies in the experience the awareness makes. If it makes a limited experience and one of suffering through vasanas,
yeah,
or one of its true self.
That's right. That's right. That's
and,
great.
So the only wrongdoing could be his self not being aware of its true nature.
Correct.
Which is pure awareness.
Yes.
Furthermore, what is to stop people from justifying their tamasic and rajasic behavior like violence and causing suffering to others?
Nothing. Nothing is going to prevent people from doing that. Ishvara gives you free will if you're a person. Huh? Ishvara is not a big daddy who's holding a whip over you and says, you do what I tell you. It's not like it's putting a gun to your head. If you think you're this jiva, if you think you're a person, you have free will. From the point of view you were talking, from Ishvara's point of view, it's all the same. The good stuff and the bad stuff is all the same from Ishvara's point of view, but it's not the same from jiva's point of view. Jiva can be tamasic as it and rajasic as it wants, but then it's going to have to suffer. Because that's what you get when you develop tamasic and rajasic vasanas. You suffer. And when you, that's what you get. That's the consequence of rajas and tamas is suffering. And the consequence of sattva is what? Liberation, moksha. So the jiva has to make a choice. What do I want? Do I want to suffer or not? And then the jiva has to perform actions that will what? Are in harmony with its goal. So Arjuna's not clear what he wants. That's why Krishna says this in the beginning. He just wants to run away. Krishna says people have all kinds of ideas about what the self is. If you're clear about what the self is and you know that the self is moksha. See, we're saying moksha is not something you get. Moksha is something you are. You're already free as awareness. Then, so it's not something I'm going to get. It's something I am. I am free now. If I don't understand that, you say, you say I'm free, but I don't feel free. Isn't that right? You say, but I don't feel free. Well, why are you trusting your feelings? Huh? Why do you believe what your feelings are telling you about who you are? Huh? Your feelings are. Why do you trust those?
Habit to.
Huh?
Out of habit.
Just out of habit. Yeah. You think your feelings are telling you who you are. You think how you feel is validating you. But how you think or what you're feeling doesn't have anything to do with you at all. Why do you trust how you feel?
think.
Or think. How you feel or think. That's correct. What you think yourself is beyond your feelings and your thoughts. Your feelings come from here, your thoughts come from here. They're all in the subtle body. And whatever is playing in the subtle body is the result of the gunas, and the gunas are what are maya, and maya is ignorance. So everything here, your feelings are all ignorance. You can't trust them. One minute you feel one way, and the next minute you feel another way. Isn't that right? Huh? One minute life looks great, and the next minute life looks rotten. What's the truth? There is no truth in your feelings. See? There's only truth in knowledge. Knowledge is what you cannot dismiss. You cannot destroy or negate or get rid of knowledge. That's something that's eternal, and it always is. That's what you should trust. You should, a life should be built on knowledge, not on experience or feelings. Understand this very well.
Yeah, but how to decide which knowledge you should follow? Of course we trust you, but...
No, you have to trust the scripture. Never mind me, but I tell you, this worked for me.
You can read the scripture this or the other way.
Well, sure, that's right, but you're not, that's correct, but you're not meant to read the scripture. Because the person who's reading the scripture is what? Ignorant of the truth. So his or her vasanas are going to interpret the scripture according to his or her vasanas. So one person will read it and come to one conclusion according to his or her knowledge or ignorance, and another person will read it and come to a different conclusion based upon his or her knowledge or his or her experience. So you're not meant to read the scripture or interpret the scripture. Yes?
So it's Ishvara's grace which leads you through Vedanta.
That's correct. And Vedanta, and you need to be taught. That's the point. I'm not saying that because I'm a teacher. No, you know, honestly. I'm saying that because I'm a student. See? I realized that I needed to be taught. I realized that I couldn't figure it out. I'm a very smart person. I'm not stupid. But I could not crack this code. I could not figure it out. And I tried, I spent every waking day for 4 years on this problem of who am I. I did nothing but that. I quit my job, I left my girlfriend, I had money tucked away. I didn't do anything but like meditate and pray and read scripture and study and associate with sages and gurus and so forth and so on. And after 4 years, every day on it, I realized I had failed completely. I'm a bright guy, and I worked like a devil dog, and I never got it. Finally, I just said, forget it. I give up. I quit. I surrendered. I just said, okay. And then the next thought I had was, get a job, you useless guy. Get a job. Do something useful for the society. Do something useful for yourself. Live your life. And that very day, a whole miraculous series of events happened that led me to my guru. And I felt so naked. I felt like I was 2 years old. Like I was a tiny little baby, even though I was 30. I felt like a little baby. I felt so innocent and so stupid. And it felt so good. And I just opened up my mind. And Ishvara just taught me through this teaching, through the Vedanta. Anyway, how are we doing here? Yeah, let's take five. We haven't even read, isn't it? What time did we start?
Three? Well, we started three, and we could finish six, and as you like, we can have a break.
Okay. How are we doing? You want a break, or should we do a little more?
A little more.
Huh?
Half an hour more.
Yeah, a little more. Okay, good. Let me take off my coat. I'm getting heated up.
So emotional. Maybe you can answer another question.
I'm getting emotional. No, speech is the fire chakra. It's the fire energy. It's the throat chakra, and it produces a lot of shakti. You get hot. Okay.
Can I?
Yeah. Sure.
I was thinking about what you said yesterday about that reality is flat.
Yeah, that's
right. Somehow it.
That's what non-dual means.
So it means from a point of awareness.
Everything
you are aware of is the same, and
yes,
so it's flat.
That's right.
It's not that this is attracting me, this is
that
distracting me.
Absolutely. It's like a mirror.
Yeah.
It's like awareness is a big mirror. Huh? And now in a mirror, huh, you'll see a whole... So you take this room. Okay, now if there's a mirror here, on this side, on this wall, all the everything in the room will appear in that mirror, won't it? Huh? But will anything be sticking out from the mirror? Will you be? Huh? No. Everything will be in the same dimension. There'll be, huh?
And so when you're watching from a point of upadi.
Uh-huh.
There are things which you like and don't like, and this makes it like three-dimensional.
That's right.
And
that's
that
called
means
Maya.
Everything is the same. And
that's right.
It's just objects.
Maya makes it look like there's time and space. Maya makes it look like you're there and I'm here, that there's dimension, that there's space and time, and three dimensions. But it's not like that at all. There's just one reality, and it's just flat, and it's like a mirror, and in which all, or a movie screen, all the objects are appearing and disappearing.
So also what I feel, what I hear, what I think, it's everything like a flat reality.
Absolutely. And I am that in which objects are appearing and disappearing.
You're just flowing in this flat...
I'm just observing the changes taking place on the screen, on my screen, in my awareness. What did I do with my glasses? It's the funniest thing. Didn't I have glasses? I'm getting old. You get old, you know, you get...
I don't know where my glasses are. Not yet.
Where was it?
You didn't start the text, no?
I know, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, so maybe you don't have your glasses.
Well, maybe I don't have to. Well, I'm sure I brought my glasses. Oh, there they are.
Oh.
It's like the self, huh? Thank you. It's like the self. You know, here I am looking for my glasses, and my glasses are here. I'm looking through my glasses. I did that the other day. I was looking for my glasses through my glasses. That's like looking for the self. You're looking for the self. You are the self. Okay, we'll get on with this. Let me have a drink here. Oh, that's good. Okay, Karma Yoga. The steadiness of... So, yeah, we just finished verse 47 and 48. This steadiness of mind that we've just been talking about, Karma Yoga. Now, verse 49. Verse 49 says, desire-prompted action is inferior to action performed with the Karma Yoga attitude. Inferior for whom? Inferior for a spiritual person who wants moksha. For a samsari, for a worldly person, it's not inferior. Understand? Take refuge in this attitude. Those who perform action only for desired results are misers. Desired objective results. Now we're, as spiritual people, we want a result. Let's get this clear. We want a result. But the result is different from what worldly people want. What is the result we want? Peace of mind. That's our result. We're going for a clear, peaceful, still mind. So we can, you can tell whether your karma yoga is working or not if your mind is becoming slowly more peaceful, week to week, month to month. If it's not, you're not doing karma yoga properly. Understand? We do want a result, but the result is not the object outside that we want. We want the peace of mind that comes from what? Renouncing the results. Letting Ishwar tell us what we need. There's a beautiful saying in the Course in Miracles. From what you want, God won't save you. So just be careful what you want. We go for a peace of mind and you're fine. But you get what you want and you may not be happy at all. In fact, you won't be happy. Why? Because you'll just get a vasana for want and you'll want some more. And the more you want, what are you saying about yourself? What are you saying when you say I want? You're saying I'm lacking. Isn't it? That's all a want is. It's just a statement. I'm incomplete. That's all you're saying. So wanting things is not it's not a great smart thing to do, really. Look and see what you have already and count your blessings and be happy with what you have and just pack it in on your wants. If you can't do that, then do the karma yoga, do the attitude of karma yoga, and do your actions and leave the results to Bhagavan. The karma yoga attitude causes steadiness of mind and frees one of good and bad karma in the world. Of good karma too? No, I want to be free of the bad karma. I don't want the, I want to keep the good karma. Sorry. We don't want good karma and we don't want bad karma. We want to be free of karma altogether. Therefore, commit your mind, yourself, to karma yoga. Karma yoga is discretion in action. You have to choose. At every you have to use your discrimination. If every action, there are a whole bunch of actions that are prohibited for karma yogis, and there are certain actions that are enjoined. That is, you're supposed to do when you're a karma yogi, and you need to like look. And this is why you consecrate an action, like. Like, I wanted to kill my wife the other day. So I thought, I want to strangle her. We're having a fight. Okay? So I said, okay, Bhagavan, I'm going to do this as karma yoga. Bhagavan, this one's for you, Bhagavan. Will that be karma yoga? That won't be karma yoga. That won't be karma yoga. Why? Because it's a violation of dharma in the first place, isn't it? So by offering it to Bhagavan, all I'm doing is what? Sanctifying that action. But I won't offer Bhagavan a bad action. Because I don't want a bad result, do I? Bhagavan will say, oh, you consecrated your wife's murder to me? Oh, that's good. I'll give you a nice big jail sentence. That's what Bhagavan will give you for that action. You say, oh, this one's for you, Bhagavan. And Bhagavan says, I'll give you a nice dull mind. Yeah, you'll just, Bhagavan, yeah. So actions what? Prohibited actions. Rajasic and tamasic actions you won't be doing. You'll only be offering Bhagavan actions that produce results that what? Are in harmony with Bhagavan's desire for you. Which is what? Moksha. Because the desire you have for freedom is just Bhagavan, it's just the self in your heart asking to be free. Please, please help me, set me free. I'm already free and you're putting me in this cage of desire and fear. You're putting me in here. I want out. I want to be free. With the karma yoga attitude, the wise, no longer concerned with the results of their action and free from the bondage of rebirth, accomplish the result that is free of limitation. What is that? What is the result that's free of limitation? Self-knowledge. There's no limitation in self-knowledge because the self is limitless. Freedom means I'm limitless. So there's no limitation. If that's the result we want, we want freedom from limitation. In fact, if you look every day, what we're doing every day is trying to get rid of a sense of limitation, isn't it? Everything you do is an attempt to get rid of this feeling of being limited. I got bitten by a mosquito. So what do? I scratch. Why? Why are you scratching? Because the itch limits me. Huh? It takes away my pleasure. The pleasure of me. The pleasure of being me is suddenly limited by this itch, this little pain, and so I try to relieve the itch to get back what? The feeling of pleasure. And as soon as I take it away, I feel my pleasure again. I feel myself. Then it itches, I do it again. Whatever you do is an attempt to remove this sense of limitation. If you're feeling lonely, why do you fall in love? Why do you fall in love? To relieve a feeling of loneliness. You want someone else to torture you. Sorry. That was the wrong word. When your intellect is no longer deluded, you will become dispassionate concerning what has happened and what will happen. When your mind is no longer concerned with the results promised in the Vedas or promised in your own mind, never mind the Vedas, it remains steady and becomes established in the self. This leads to self-knowledge. So you see the connection between karma yoga, desire, and action, and self-knowledge? It's all very carefully connected. Okay. Now, people are always saying, you know, get on the internet. I never saw so many enlightened people. Huh? My God, everybody's enlightened nowadays. Isn't it? God, the websites. Oh, everybody. Everybody. I'm awareness. I'm enlightened. Come to me. All this and all that and so forth and so on. It's just turned out to be a big status symbol. Huh? It's kind of, in the spiritual world, it's like the biggest status symbol. I'm enlightened, you're not. I'm experiencing something special, something you're not. I know something you don't know. See, all this game in the book, the enlightenment game. So, and it's been, that's been that way forever. Believe me, when this was written 2,300 years ago or 2,500 years ago, when this Gita was written, everybody was running around saying, I'm enlightened too. Okay? It's just, human beings are very funny. They're status conscious. Huh? They just, they want to feel, they want to be the best. They want to be on top. They don't want to be small. They don't want to be on the bottom. Now, I lived in the Philippines at one time when I was quite young. And the Filipinos, there's a lot of sun there. And you'll see the women in, walking around, and there's no rain, with umbrellas. Huh? And why are they walking with umbrellas? It's sunny and hot out. Because they don't want their skin to get dark. Huh? They're terrified of because they determine how important and beautiful you are based upon how white your skin is. Because if you're black, if you're dark skinned, then you're low caste, and if you're white skin, then you're high caste. They even now their skin bleaching and all sorts of things. See? Now, and you see it here, wealth. There's all these people on the top, the billionaires. Used to be you could be a millionaire and you had status. Now, you're nothing. A millionaire is nothing. You have to be a billionaire. And even the billionaires, they have problems. So this is status conscious. We all, huh? It's called matsarya. It's comparative. This is duality. Duality is, I compare myself to you or anything else. I compare myself to what I was. I compare myself to what I will be. I'm always evaluating myself with reference to something or somebody else. And enlightenment has gotten to be the big status game. And now you, it isn't even so good to be enlightened anymore. Now you need to be an avatar. Now, all the enlightened people are there, but now there's avatars. Because they're better than the enlightened people. Have you noticed that? Have you seen that? Yeah, the avatars. And then, when you get so many avatars, then somebody has got to invent another status which is better so he can push the rest of them down so he can stay on the top. Yeah, I don't know if you heard of that Adida. He was a famous guru years ago. He died 10 years ago. He was a kind of sex guru, and he lived in America in Fiji. He had a huge ashram. And he made a list, or all of them do this, they all love to do this, of the levels of enlightened beings. Huh? Have you seen those lists? Oh yeah, oh the gurus, they fix up all these lists. And he had seven layers. And then he had Buddha on lines 5, and Jesus on line 4, and Ramana on line 6, and I forget who on line. Nobody got past. He was the only one on line 7.
My trainer just died 2 years ago. He did the same thing.
Oh,
it's a
seven, yeah. Uh-huh. Hey, reality's non-dual. There's no status here. Nobody's higher or lower. Huh? These people have got they're completely hypnotized by duality. And they're trying to make a big story out of a fact The fact is, everybody is awareness. If we're all awareness, then how am I going to be better than you?
More awareness.
pure awareness.
So all we have to do is read the scripture to know that there can't be more, because reality is non-dual, so awareness is non-dual, so there can't be more or less awareness. On the subtle body level, you can have more or less apparently more or less reflected awareness. Depending on the guna that's playing in your subtle body at the time, you will feel like you're more aware or less aware. On this level. That's where they're all coming from. They're all coming from Maya, and they're all trying to say, I'm the highest person here, in this world. Huh? But if you're in this world, you're not even real. So what the Gita says is, okay, here's your checklist. You think you're enlightened? Okay, fair enough. I don't care. You say you're enlightened? Okay, we'll check up and tell you what an enlightened person is. And you can see if that's true or not. And you'll find this every time throughout the Gita, that this is about five or six of these sections that I call a self-realized person. It just tells you what it is, and this is just meant for your own, to check yourself to see if this is true for you. If it's true for you, then you qualify as an enlightened person. Okay? Arjuna said, O Krishna, will you please describe a person of steady wisdom, one whose mind is not disturbed by anything and abides in the self? How do such people interact with the world? Actually, he actually says, how do they walk? How do they talk? He says like that. In India, I don't know if I should tell you. Is it okay if I tell you stories and make you laugh?
Yes,
we'll never get through with this. But there's a guy, you know, there's this feeling that when you're enlightened, there's no world. Everything's gone. It's just light. And you're like a zombie. And you walk, you talk very slow. And you walk like a zombie because you are controlled by Ishwara. You see in the spiritual world people acting enlightened. Oh, just smile on their face. That's another one. They get this funny spiritual smile, and they feel if they're showing any feelings at all other than bliss, then they're not enlightened. So even though in their heart, in their eyes, you see all the pain, they have this funny smile, and they're just hugging you and trying to be spiritual, show you how much love they have. You know, it's just an act. You see it all over. So Arjuna's seen all these fakers. All these people pretending to be enlightened and spiritual. And he wants to know, tell me, what is this? What are these enlightened people? What are they really like? Well, Krishna replied, and here's your checklist. Krishna replied, when a person gives up desires as they appear in the mind, Arjuna, and remains happy with only his or herself, he or she is a discriminating person. What is that? Gives up the desires as they appear in the mind. Well, now, why would you do that? You're sitting here, you're aware, and a desire comes up. Why would you just give it up? Because you know that acting out that desire will not make you any more or less aware. any more or less happy. That the results of actions don't complete you in any way. Why? Because you're already full. The self is called Purnaha. Purnaha or Purna means full. I'm already full. You can't add anything to me that will make me bigger. It's like the ocean. The ocean never gets bigger. What? Water's always coming into it, but it never gets bigger. Well, it does now, because the icebergs are melting. But the understanding is, hey, something happens, doesn't what? Modify me or change me a bit. The knowledge of, we said that the self is ordinary, actionless, non-dual, uncreated, unconcerned awareness. It means what? It doesn't, and it's limitless. It has no limits. The self is limitless. Now, what does limitless mean? You hear that all the time. To be free is to be limitless, to have no limits. And what do you think when you think limitless? Well, you think, oh, I'm like Superman. I can jump tall buildings, just boop. I can fly through the air. Huh? Isn't it? I can cure cancer with my chakra. I have unlimited powers. Or, I am so vast, I stretch out billions of light years into the future and billions of light years. Huh? We have all these notions of limitless, what it means. Spatial notions, temporal notions of limitlessness. But you know what limitlessness actually means? Means whatever happens doesn't change me. I am not limited by what happens. Now I was telling you about the mosquito bite. What point of view was I talking from? The jiva. The jiva. From the individual's point of view, huh? I feel limited by what happens, don't I? Isn't it?
Otherwise you wouldn't itch.
Otherwise I wouldn't itch. That's correct. Otherwise I wouldn't itch. Because I've got to get rid of the itch so I feel limitless again. But from awareness's point of view, that itch doesn't change me at all, does it? I don't become unaware when I start itching, do I? When the itch appears, do I suddenly become unaware? Do I become more aware? No. I just remain as awareness, and then the itch appears here, and then my little hand comes in awareness and scratches the itch. There's my jiva. My jiva wants to what? Get rid of that itch, and I just watch my jiva and try to remove the itch.
So you let the scratching happen.
You can let it happen or not. Either way. Yeah. It can happen, it cannot happen. Because what? I, awareness, am not affected by what happens. That's what he's saying. This is the knowledge. That's a discriminating person. Discriminating means I know I'm awareness, I know I'm not what's happening. Understand? I experience whatever is happening is an object known to me. And therefore, it can't be me. Huh? If I see it, it can't be me. I have to be the seer. Isn't that correct? Huh? That's right. Huh? Like if you say, well, I'm ignorant and I'm not enlightened, and you see that thought, are you ignorant and not enlightened? No, you're not ignorant and not enlightened. You're the one that what? Sees the thought, I'm ignorant and not enlightened. Understand? So whatever happens, whatever thought or feeling, these people, they know it doesn't affect them. Because they are awareness. It's even wrong to say they call them a people, isn't it? The one who is unaffected by adversity means bad things, who doesn't yearn for pleasure, doesn't want to feel good. If you want to feel good, you're not enlightened. You're not the self. The jiva wants to feel good, but the self doesn't want to feel good.
Because if you feel good, you feel bad too. Otherwise, you wouldn't feel good.
Pardon?
If you feel good, you have to feel bad before. So you're in duality.
That's right. Feel good is related to feel bad. So that means you're what? You're a jiva in duality. Good feelings and bad feelings, this is duality. Those affect the jiva, but they don't affect awareness. Yes?
So it would still be a kind of ignorance to try so hard to make that the jiva feels better. I have to feel good, or I have to feel good, otherwise I'm ignorant.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it doesn't matter how I feel as a jiva.
Yeah, unless you see the ignorance working there.
Yes.
If you see that you're trying to make yourself feel good, then you're not trying to make yourself feel good. You're the one who sees, right? Because it's natural to try to make, it's natural for the jiva to try to make itself feel good. Because it feels bad most of the time. Doesn't it?
But I should not blame myself if it doesn't work.
That's right.
Or it comes all back to the point to say, don't trust your any thought.
Don't trust the thoughts. Yeah, absolutely.
Or feelings.
Or the feelings. Just they see them as objects. Yes.
So don't trust your intuition?
Absolutely not. Yeah, intuition is completely unreliable. One minute, Did you ever fall in love with somebody on the basis of intuition? And then they changed, right? No, they didn't change. My intuition changed. Now I intuit that he's not worthy of love. The feeling changes. Now, intuition is incredibly unreliable. It's just experience. It's just subtle vasanas at play. What they call intuition is very, very, very subtle feelings. And those are subject to change like anything else. Yes?
But it can be good as an instrument for the jiva, instrument for psychological health.
Yeah, it could be. It could be, but you need to keep an eye on your intuitions, because you can have two different intuitions about the same object, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can. Yes, ma'am.
There's a difference between higher and lower intuition, as I see it. The higher kind of intuition leads you to the path of Ishvara. With a higher intuition, a jiva will do what Ishvara is wanting, and lower intuition is on the base of feelings.
Okay, but that's true, but how do you know what's higher intuition and what's lower intuition?
Then you have to discriminate.
Yeah, and what is the basis of your discrimination?
It's just awareness.
Knowledge of awareness would have to be. But from awareness's point of view, there's no need to discriminate between higher and lower intuition, because higher intuition is awareness and lower intuition is awareness, isn't it? But awareness is not intuition. In other words, intuition, higher intuition and lower intuition are both objects appearing in awareness. Now, from the jiva's point of view, it's very dangerous to follow intuition. Although if you really are a pure-minded person and you trust those feelings, that's called following your heart, it probably will lead you to what? To this teaching in one way or another. It could. But you can't count on it. We're not against it, because an intuition can be true or it can be false. But we need a standard by which we can evaluate our intuitions. Because intuition is just experience, once again. And the thing about human beings is, they're never objective. They're never fair. They always have an agenda. They always want something, or they are afraid of something. And where you have those desires and those fears, there you cannot rely on the person. When the fears and desires are operating, you can't trust them. You can't trust that part of yourself. See? That's what we're saying. That's why we're objectifying our desires and our fears. And we're talking about awareness, because awareness and knowledge gives us a context whereby we can evaluate everything. Because Vedanta is the big picture. This knowledge of awareness includes everything. Understand? Because awareness is the background, the container for everything. Everything appears in awareness. And that's the ultimate point of view. From that point of view, you can say this is this and that's that. Because it's not personal. But everything in this Maya field is personal. And it's controlled by the vasanas. And those vasanas will always cause you to make mistakes. I'm awareness, but James makes mistakes. James does dumb things. James says stupid things and does dumb things. But I'm fine with James doing that. I really am. I'm really fine. James doesn't have to be perfect. James can make mistakes. James can do dumb things. It's just fine. I love James so much that I let him do whatever he wants. And if he gets whacked, I'm happy for him to get whacked. And if he gets blessed, I'm happy for him to get blessed. Whatever he wants to do, I let him do. Because I trust him and I love him. And it's okay. It's not about fixing me. Huh? It's not about fixing this jiva. You're perfect and pure as a jiva, as you are. You don't need to be different. You don't need to be better. We're not trying to make you better here. This sadhana isn't to make you better. This sadhana is to just get your mind clear so you can understand that you're okay, whoever you are. You're okay as a jiva, and you're okay as Ishvara, and you're okay as awareness. Everything's okay. That's what we're saying. We just want you to understand that and not try to change yourself. Don't try to change yourself. Because you didn't create yourself, and you're perfect as you are. You're serving a purpose and a function here. And you're beautiful. And you're useful. And so don't try to be different. When ignorance is operating, I'm never satisfied with who I am. And I want to be better, or more perfect, or pure, or holy, or good. That's what I am. And so I set up this ideal person. And I think, if I was really this kind of beautiful person, I'll be okay. And the problem is, the closer you get to that, the more dissatisfaction you become, and the goal becomes more and more further away. And you work, and the goal moves. And you never get to be perfect by becoming, by trying to change yourself. That's called the world of becoming. You're always wanting to become something. And it never ends. And it's a complete frustration. It's so painful to try to be something that you're not. Awareness is love, and love is unconditional. We call it Parama Prema Swarupa. It means the nature of awareness is pure love. And pure love accepts everything as it is. It embraces and encompasses everything as it is. Why? Because everything is you. The good and the bad, all of the dharma and adharma, everything here is good. It's good. It's okay. It's you. It's God. It's Shiva. I understand that. And so I'm not trying to fix me or change me. Understand this. You have to stop trying to fix ourselves. Nobody's broken here. Everybody's just perfectly as they are, where they are. So all Ishwara is doing it. It's got to be perfect.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Vedanta, yoga and self-inquiry, visit shiningworld.com, yogavidya.de or meinyogalehrer.de.